That's the first. That is the main point. Now we're just going to follow up. Then I'll try to bring it to why I'm discussing it. Saying the same thing now, just from a different letter. Jung writes, and so, by the way, this Buber-Jung controversy was Buber, you know, he was a Jewish theologian, actually I quite like in many ways, and Jung drew a lot from him in his Transference essay, which is another old story, but Buber criticized Jung very hotly in print for psychologizing God. That's what the theologians say. Jung is psychologizing God. And you see, that is a statement of somebody who has not understood Kant. Because all we know of God is our psychological experience. So the conversation just stops at that point. And then what they try to do, all the fashion now, is to build a bridge between psychology and religion. And in fact, if you understand religion wrongly, there's no way to possibly build a bridge, because there is no such thing as religion in the way it has been understood, because that is a subjective confession, as we will see. So just stay with the idea, there are two kinds of people: those who say I know God, and those who say I know my experience of God. As I pointed out in our Saturday group, you know, Tony Blair, George Bush, both said God sanctified the invasion of Iraq in their prayers. Al-Qaeda's diaries were found by Americans when they were fleeing in Afghanistan, in which dreams were recorded where Allah came to them and said, "You must destroy America." See, this is the problem: that if you believe in metaphysical certainty, that is the beginning of war. But if you can say, "Well, that's what my experience of Allah is," or "That's what my experience of God is that right?" Then you open up the field for discourse. But as long as you are coming out of the position, I am divinely right, there is no dialogue, and when there's no dialogue, there's war. Joseph Campbell tells a story just about Buber, that he was at a conference, and Buber was talking about the death of God. And Campbell raised his hand and said, "Now, which God are you talking about? Because I've just come back from India." And there, Krishna was alive and well in colorful celebration. And Buber said, "Do you mean to compare?" And Campbell said, "Yes, I do. I'm a comparative mythologist." So you see how that the people call Jung psychologizing religion are the very ones who stick to their dogmatic interpretation where there's no dialogue. Like my student said, "No, that's the way it is. End of discussion." So it's not only important, I think, you know, psychologically, this is what we're talking about, but just think of the implications for history today. Two religions at war. That's really what's going on. One self-righteously, "God bless America." The other self-righteously, "Allah says we must destroy you." And that's what they believe. So as long as there is no relativity of experience, there's conflict. So it's very important historically, I think. And why, really, I just detest the literal interpretation of this stuff. It's so dangerous, and it's promulgated with such naivete and innocence. So now, just saying the same thing in different words. "And so indeed it is, for here that threshold which separates two epochs," remember Ion, "plays the principal role. I mean by that threshold the theory of knowledge whose starting point is Kant. On that threshold minds go their separate ways, those who have understood Kant and the others that cannot follow him." So one of the reasons Jung wrote Ion was to show how this is not just a philosophical nicety, but we are at a time where we need to change our understanding of what God is, and Kant was the guy who laid it out. And it's the difference, again, that simple difference between saying I know God and I know my experience of God. I'm just laying the groundwork. We will keep going. Now, it gets a little bit more complicated. Jung again. My human limitation, okay, this is the ant business. My human limitation does not permit me to assert that I know God. Hence, I cannot but regard all assertions about God as relative because subjectively conditioned. So that our experience of God says as much about the perceiving apparatus that receives it, namely my psyche, as it does any attempt to describe the object of my knowledge. And I love this next one. You wouldn't have anticipated our current war, but it applies. Let me go back and reread to give you the final clause. My human limitation does not permit me to assert that I know God, hence I cannot but regard all assertions about God as relative because subjectively conditioned, and this out of respect for my brothers. Beautiful. Whose other conceptions and beliefs have as much to justify them as mine.
Now that's a democracy.
That's democracy. See, we're still leaving the Middle Ages. If I'm a psychologist, I shall try to take these differences seriously and understand them. But under no circumstances shall I assume that if the other person doesn't share my opinion, it is due to a deformity or lack of an organ.
A brain?
Well, that student would have said, well, you just don't have the capacity to understand God.
Yeah. Did you say that to
you? No, I mean, that's what they would have said.
Okay.
You know, I have the truth. I have the ability to receive the truth. You don't. Mm-hmm. You're shut down. Mm-hmm. Though I am sure of my subjective experience, I must impose on myself every conceivable restriction in interpreting it. I must guard against identifying with my subjective experience. I consider all such identifications as serious psychological mistakes. See, two thresholds. And we are now entering into a time when this is becoming more and more crucial. I must guard against identifying with my subjective experience. Oh, these are all on pages 3 to 12, so you won't have trouble finding them in this book.
Thank you.
Now, the emotional importance of that I stress, but also for our time and how why I find the metaphysical certainty so offensive. I cannot but regard all assertions about God as relative because subjectively conditioned. That's subjectively conditioned, I want to reflect on for a second, because now getting closer to our text. The implication of that is the way we conceive of God is through our own psychological filters. Our own psychological capacity for perception is what determines our experience. Therefore, our descriptions of our experience are descriptions of our psyche. So statements about God are statements about our inner perceptive system that perceives it.
Same case we made about science, though.
Well, that's a little more complicated. I think what's different here is this, what Kant's getting at anyway, is that the problem is that the finite is trying to understand the infinite.
Okay.
Now, there is another problem with science, but it's slightly different.
So it has a similar
epistemological issue to it, yeah.
Okay.
Otherwise, how could we think at one point that the force equals mass times acceleration, and now we know it doesn't anymore? But that's what I want to get you to feel, and why I'm going through this slowly is so you can really, you can not just understand it, but you can articulate it to yourself why. That when you talk about religion, you're talking about yourself. So the Bible is a portrait of our psyche. The image of God in the Bible is an image of the part of ourselves that we don't know. Our statements of God are statements about the part of our personality we don't know. Again, Jung is never saying God is nothing but that. He's just saying our experience of God is that. And that's where discussion breaks down. That's why Buber and Jung could never come to a resolution. They will say, you're saying God is that. Jung is saying, I am not saying God is that. I am saying that is the perception of God, which is a reflection of your perceiving categories. And your perceiving categories are embedded in who you are. And therefore, statements about God are statements about who you are. Now think about that for a second. Yahweh sees the Canaanites, go in there and kill them. What did they do wrong? The image of God is an image of a murderer. And what has our civilization done since day one? But propagate war. This is its origin. And the literalization of religion is the way we avoid seeing who we are, because we say, oh, that's not us. And as soon as you try to say that's us, you're accused of religious relativism. But in fact, that imagery is a portrait of what we are actually doing but are in denial of. Okay? It's so important. It is not disrespecting religion. It's trying to honor religious experience and also honor that of our neighbor, I think. And to stop using religion as a crutch to cover up the shadow.
Well, this is complicated because Jung uses an awful lot of theological terms in discussing things without necessarily, but always assuming that you understand.
That's a metaphor.
Yes.
Right. Religion is metaphor. Mm. Which is not to say God is.
Right.
Really. Big difference.
Because when he's asking those interviews, if he believes, he says, I believe, I know.
Yeah.
Again, that's his personal experience.
My personal experience is there a God, is that there is a God.
And that he knows that.
And he knows that. Right. Now, I'm anticipating the argument a bit, but see, what Pauli is going to say is that God could not possibly be conscious, because look how wretched the world is. Which is actually not a bad way to put it. How could a God exist who is conscious when children are blown up in Iraq, or children are burnt in gas ovens in Nazi Germany? That's a pretty persuasive argument against God. Pauli puts it against the consciousness of God. Jung's point of view is no, that is not quite right, because there is a God who is not conscious but capable of consciousness.
Say that again. There is a God that is unconscious.
There is, the God is unconscious, but capable of consciousness. Or, yeah, one says there is a God of no consciousness, and Jung says there is a God of unconsciousness that is capable of consciousness. And that's the answer to Job. And the human...
Is it that when you become conscious, that's when the synchronicity happens? Is that possible?
Might have something to do with it, but I would put it more, and this is where I disagree with, you know, is the child sexually abused and they still reach their goal in life, is that the job of the ego is to witness justice and outrage back to God. Injustice and outrage back to God.
Is to...
Witness.
In the theological sense.
Just in the emotional sense. God, I do not accept this. I do not assume, as some people have told me, that you know what you're doing. You don't know what you're doing. Look at history and wake up. And that's the job of the second, the new eon we're entering. Mm-hmm. This is why Jung wrote Answer to Job. Mm-hmm. The ego registers the injustice, experiences the outrage, carries it, and expresses it.
Now, would you say that's the Western?
That's Western.
Definitely.
It's all meaningful. And the Western is, we have to make sure that the meaning is brought forth.
To bring God consciousness.
To bring God consciousness. Yeah.
I'm just trying to think, you know, if you look at our politics, there's just so much injustice that should be enraging people. But
exactly, it's not.
Where is it going? I mean,
cancer,
mm-hmm. Obesity,
addictions, cynicism.
It's an energy somewhere.
Child molesting,
murder.
So, if that is happening less in the Eastern way, maybe they are onto something.
They might be onto something, but it's not my way. That's the problem. Although I can tell you, I lived in the Orient, and in Korea. Speaking of bombs, my language teacher said, you know, when I was a nubile young girl, and somebody pinched me on the behind, inevitably he was wearing an orange robe.
He's a monk.
It's just as decadent there as it is here. Buddhism is no better there than Christianity is here. I'm not trying to make a comment on the essence of Buddhism, like I wouldn't make a comment on the essence of Christianity, but it's the same decadence. It's an unrealizable ideal. Okay, but back to the argument. Now, why are we making such a fuss of this? Because our statements of that God are descriptions of ourself. So when Pauli says God is not capable of consciousness, he is saying, I am not capable of consciousness. That is very serious.
But I hate to belabor this, but in the dream chair, the Chinese are coming up in a very powerful way, right? And is that not saying to him that he needs to take in some of this piece?
It's a balance. But we have to distinguish, we have to develop both sides before there can be a synthesis. Otherwise, it's just a mush.
And so that might be even involved in this synthesis of spirit and matter also.
Definitely. They're the same. Yeah. And Jung is saying that we are capable of consciousness. That's what this comes down to. And that's why I've made such a fuss about it. To try to show you why Jung says that statements of God are really statements about ourselves. And you really can feel that. And you can really distinguish what of Jungian psychology coming your way in the future is pre-Kant, and what is post-Kant.
Now, you would probably say that the statements are not, you can't really make a statement, but the symbols do come close to linking up to God, right?
The symbols. No, the symbols are a part of our perceptual
mechanism. Well, they come closer, don't they?
Assembly. You're looking for certainty, honey, and there just ain't none.
Well, I know he was talking about that the symbols were defective, but that they need to be new symbols that would be.
But that's a psychological discussion. Sorry. I would love to satisfy you, but I can't.
I mean, it wasn't you that he wanted to see.
Yeah, but I mean, I've said it now 10 times. These are psychological statements. We don't know what will happen, and here is the epoch business. I'm getting off point a little bit, but just for the sake of discussion. We don't know what will happen if it ever comes to the point where we can take responsibility for what I just said. In other words, if Christianity can be integrated, what will happen? We don't know. Maybe there'll be another revelation. At which time it will seem that that's the truth. But at this moment, there are enough people aware that there's a distinction between knowledge and experience that a thoughtful person, I don't think, can any longer entertain metaphysical certainty.
So you're saying for Christianity to be integrated, then our foregoing conversation would have to be conscious generally?
We would have to recognize how our God image is a statement of ourself, and how we would grow until that God image becomes conscious.
And then you're saying we don't know what that would
mean. We don't know what would happen next.
Okay.
But you said that he said we are able to be conscious. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
That's why this is going to be such a big deal. Pauli is going to fight the idea that God can become conscious, and we're going to see it's a reflection of his unwillingness to accept the fact that he can become conscious.
It doesn't
mean
have to do the same. Doesn't all
have to? Sure. Definitely. I mean, that's what's so scary about this conflict.
Yeah.
It looks like it has no end.
Right.
Not for a long time. Because those of you who have done work on the inner God image know how slow it evolves. In other words, that your whole value system changes. Not just in what you say, but in the way you live. That's a work of a lifetime. And that's for one individual who actually is paying money and caring about their growth.
And yet the gods seem to transform every 2,000 years, nonetheless, no matter... I suppose the way they transform depends on that.
I think you could say that what's going on now is a transformation of God. The problem is which is going to happen first, their transformation or our destruction.
Mm-hmm.
So that the game has really anteed up.
And, well, that sort of speaks to my idea about the path not really being laid out. The clock idea of the eons being a clockwork fantasy.
Yeah, I see your point. I think what Edinger really made that point, that more, you know, to look in the past and stop saying it could have been otherwise. So with respect to the past, to see it as this is what had to be. But with respect to the future, realizing the human choice can make a difference.
But really having to play both sides of the issue at the
mm-hmm.
same time,
that there is this fire that's assaulting us, which is objective and we have to deal with, but we do have choice about the way we respond to it. And that dialogue between that fire and our choice determines the course of the future. Yes.
Which is, when you say that to integrate Christianity, you mean to recognize that God image is ourselves.
Is a subjective entity.
A subjective, would also mean that we would look at other religions differently.
Right, right. Right.
And not automatically dismiss those as
completely. Yeah. I think interestingly that this approach that you're suggesting, I think it kind of draws back the physical approach, like in physics, wherein more and more you don't see that some understanding is false necessarily, but that there is a bigger view which encompasses that earlier view and gives a fuller meaning. You know, like with Newton, you know, idea of mechanics or physics. Then you have Einstein. Einstein didn't see that he was, doing away with the understanding of Newton, but that you bring Newton into a bigger understanding. And we're thinking about religion in the same way. You can think of religion.
Could be.
That you have this religion and this religion. They seem to be separate, but maybe we're looking for something that encompasses both of them.
I agree with you. The problem is that it's up to each individual to fight this battle.
Right.
And the battle now is, can you recognize your own image of God, not in thought, but in fact, and begin to transform it?
What do you think about the idea, Jung makes the comment somewhere in his works about the Islamic world being our younger brothers and sisters psychologically? It's almost as though he's putting the onus on Christianity to become conscious first and to reach out to the Muslim community as a younger brother or sister.
I don't know, Carol. If I had two lifetimes, I would attack that one as well. I think it's very pressing that we try to understand this conflict between Christianity and Islam from a deeper point of view and stop all the hysterics and, you know, moralisms and really examine what is going on. I only have only so many hours in a day, but you might indeed take a class in Islam and really get to know Islam and begin working on this.
You know, it's interesting. I like the thought of Thomas Merton a lot. In one of his tapes, he actually takes up seriously Sufism, and he actually had people come down to his monastery. And he saw a lot of relationship with the Sufi part of Islam and Christianity. And specifically, which is kind of what we're talking about here, is that he talks about the fact that in Sufism, there's this idea of, I think you call it popping, or reality. The universe is being dissolved and recreated momentarily, always. And then this is where the Islam idea of mercy comes in. It's only through God's mercy that as this reality is dissolved, that the world comes back into being. But it's interesting, Merton.
I'm sorry to stop you, but we really should get back to this.
No,
Merton is not really relevant.
How I relate to this is that he saw that this was relating to this whole quantum mechanical idea of uncertainty.
Uh-huh.
That in Islam, there is this idea of uncertainty, that the world itself is uncertain, that it is always dissolving and coming back into creation all the time, and that he saw there was a relationship between that thing and modern physics.
Okay, good. Can we go back to the text here?
Just a quick question. Is it through our dreams and interpreting them right and everything that we become more conscious of God?
That's the idea, that this shows up in dreams.
Okay, yeah.
And we're going to see it here in Pali's
dreams.
Well, I was just wondering why Pali, I wonder what would make him not an atheist, but say God, there is a God, but he's unconscious.
Yes. I think Pali, in a way, was a mystic in his gut.
Was a mystic
in his gut. But in his head, was a rationalist.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a compromise. Look at what Pali says on page 84. And the first paragraph is what we've talked about. He didn't understand how a God who knowingly created the world could be conscious. That's what I just said. Now here's Pali. Now interpret this psychologically, not about God, but about Pali. Such an unknowing God remains innocent and cannot be held morally responsible. Emotionally and intellectually, the difficulty no longer arises of reconciling him with the existence of sin and evil. See, that's characteristic of every statement we have seen Pali make to von Franz. He's been innocent, he has not been morally responsible, and he experienced no emotional or intellectual difficulty to reconcile him with the hurt he was causing her.
Mm-hmm. So
there it is. That's why I went through that long chain of explanation. How it is that our statements of God are really statements of ourselves. Now what we're going to watch is that Pauli starts here and he changes. But then he flips back.
I had a hard time following it in a way.
It's not easy. Let me see if I can make sense.
It wasn't fleshed out enough.
I think hopefully I can make sense of it for you. Because it changes halfway across the river. That's what's so confusing. The next paragraph, in his correspondence with Yaffe, Pauli continued to be critical of a God who was conscious. And now we'll just be hearing what I just said, hopefully. And what he does in the next paragraph is, a quote from a letter to Yaffe, in which Pauli just points out that he's both Jewish, he has a Jewish and Christian heritage. His dad was Jewish and his mom was Christian. And that, now I mention this because we're going to see the Jewish theme come up later, that for him, the Jewish tradition meant, look at the last line on page 84, the capacity to inquire into murky depths. Which I take as an old Jewish inheritance. We'll be seeing that later. Okay, but we're just going to go through now his quotes until we get to a dream, which is a response to his thoughts. He writes, then Yaffe, it's the second quote on page 85, who apparently wrote in an essay, God needs humankind in order to become conscious of himself. That's standard Jung. And then Pauli writes back, I can't accept that. Now, Schopenhauer held that God could not become conscious. That's why Schopenhauer comes in here. That God was a blind will. And that wouldn't ever change. That's not important why it's Schopenhauer. It's just that's the point is that Pauli feels this is not a possibility.
So was God unconscious for Schopenhauer?
Yes.
It's kind of almost Gnostic, right? About the demiurge.
I think in all Gnosticism, God can become conscious.
Oh, okay.
That's the whole point.
But the phenomenal world was created in part by either an insane deity or an unconscious deity.
Right.
But I guess I didn't figure that out about Gnosticism in the form to become conscious.
That's the whole point. God was created, and so this is where Jung is closer to Gnosticism than anything. When God, there are several different versions. Sometimes God is tricked into creating the world, or sometimes the creation of the world is a trick by a lesser divinity. But at any point, part of God gets trapped in the world. And God does not know what's going on. That is, I think, pretty standard Gnostic theology. But, so, there's a little piece of God in everybody. And the way we live our life should be such that when we die, the piece of God in us goes back to God. And with that is an increase in the consciousness of God. So not the basic premise of Gnosticism is that human beings have to redeem God, not that God redeems human beings. And for redeem, substitute, make conscious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was looking for a psychological term for redemption. That's good. Makes conscious.
So, again, nothing I haven't said. The middle quote, I not only reject a good God, but any God with consciousness. About halfway down that quote. As an unconscious God cannot be made responsible and is not much different than Schopenhauer's will. Again, read for God, me. I am saying I am not responsible for becoming conscious. Why? That's what I tried to explain to you at the beginning. How statements of God are really statements of ourselves. And that is what's so dangerous about not psychologically interpreting our theology.
So he are we on this quote right here? On 85?
Yes.
So he's rejecting a conscious God.
Yes.
And an unconscious God.
No.
Am I confused?
You see, or
not
maybe
only
I am.
Reject a good God, but any God with consciousness.
Uh huh.
As an unconscious God cannot be made. Oh, okay. I don't understand that sentence. I don't know why. That last sentence in that quote.
See, when he says unconscious God, he doesn't mean unconscious God in the same way that Jung means unconscious God. That might be what's confusing. I not only reject a good God, but any God with consciousness. As an unconscious God cannot be made responsible, which is what I think, parentheses, and is not much different than Schopenhauer's will.
So he thinks God should not be responsible.
He thinks God should not be responsible.
Okay.
That's the big point. So the human beings have no right to complain to God about what's happening. Which means people have no right to complain to him about how he treats them.
What you call, well, you call it narcissism, but it's also that identification.
Yeah, it's not what I call narcissism. It's what the contemporary language calls narcissism. I've used that word just to fit in.
But it is almost like identification with the God image.
Well, it is identification with the God image, and insofar as it's identification with the God image, his descriptions of the God image are descriptions of himself. See, the thing that Yahweh, I mean, if you look at Yahweh in the Old Testament with eyes that are incapable of being shocked by a heresy, God is a psychopath. If Yahweh walked into a psychologist's office and said, well, you know, I just had my employees kill 50,000 Canaanites. And you know what I really like every day is for those people to worship me. That's a pathological narcissist who harms other people and wants from the world adoration. Well, that's our image of God. And that means that's our image of ourselves that we refuse to recognize. That what we really want is to destroy and to be worshipped. Well, that's narcissism in the contemporary language. Or that's the way identification with the self works. And again, it's not to be sacrilegious. It's to begin to cut through how we deceive ourselves through religious projections. And Pauli's in the same boat. What he wants is people to admire him. And what happens to everything he touches is it's destroyed. I can't imagine how his wife stayed with him. I think she must have had no feeling and loved being Herr Dr. Professor, Frau Dr. Professor. You know, the wives were called Frau Dr. Professor, even though they might have a third grade education. They were treated with the same respect that the Herr Dr. Professor was treated. And this is what Pauli's theology is justifying. what is kind of tragic again is, remember, his creation produced the atomic age. There's more destruction. So all of this stuff is not things that are just objective theological niceties, but there are what is going on in our collective unconscious that is helping shape our collective life like it was shaping his personal life. And he was being challenged again and again to begin to see that equation. Not to beat him up, not to tear him down, but to begin to say, so where do we go from here? Where do I go from here personally? And what message then can I communicate to my times on showing them the analogy of my personal transformation to what needs to happen socially? That's why this irreverent sounding talk, I think, is so very, very important. It is not really against humanity. It's very much in the service of humanity. It's just we've got some very strange ideas about who we are, as he did. Now, he starts to change, apparently, out of the discussions with von Franz and Jaffe. And the last quote, you begin to see him question his point of view. He was reading this book by somebody who we don't know. It sounds like it was typical Protestant theology, Theologica Deutsch, German theology. It was published by Luther, although Luther didn't write it. And in it, it's the standard thing, good is good and bad is bad. And the job of the Christian is to be good. And then and the light is good, and God is good, and the dark is bad, and the devil is dark. And Pauli begins to think, I'm reading up third line from the bottom. What if one of the lights opposed not the darkness, but a false light? So he's beginning to realize, maybe it isn't quite as black and white as I thought. I was struck by the thought that the true light could not be completely true and the false light completely false. So you see, he's beginning to entertain the possibility of relativism in his previous objective understanding of God. Objective in quotes. And then he has this dream. I meet the Japanese physicist, I guess it's Nishino, who tells me that he has the task to take Chinese worker girls over the Alps to the south. He doesn't know the right way and asks if I can help him. I answer him in the positive that I know the way from my parents in Austria and that I am gladly ready to help him. At that, Nishina takes a piece of, must be paper out of his pocket titled Renewal. It is worded like a contract and obliges me as a sort of employee to help Nishina bring the girls over the Alps. I sign it quite quietly and confidently. Then I meet a woman who looks similar to my wife. She can't understand what Nishina and the Chinese have to do with me, and I am not able to make her understand, even though she happily would like to understand. As I awake, still in half sleep, the thought comes to me, I should have perhaps tried it with flowers. Now, he gives one interpretation here, and I have to say, usually I like what he says, but it just didn't work for me, what he says. I think where he's right is that the image that comes from the unconscious is the Chinese. And that introduces the idea of the relativity of good and evil. You know, remember the yin-yang symbol? There's dark and light and light and dark. And that is an image of the absence of absoluteness. And if there is polarity in the God image, then there's the possibility of consciousness. So what we, you know, when we work with dreams, we don't see that the new attitude comes in completely formed. It comes in little pieces. And here's the first little piece of a possible transformation in his understanding of God, and therefore in his understanding of himself. Now, the author says one thing, but I really have to question, do his parents in Austria know the way? I doubt it. He doesn't raise that issue. Chinese worker girls, what kind of future are they going to have? Probably not much. What difference does it make if they're on the north side of the Alps or the south side of the Alps? The south side of the Alps is a little more pleasant, but, I mean, they got nicer weather down there compared to Zurich.
That's a symbol of I Ching, though.
Is it?
The south side of the mountain and the north side of the mountain.
And what's it mean in the I Ching, you know?
South side of the mountain is Yang, the active, the created, and the north side is Yin, the dark, the shadow. Cold.
Well, if we go with that, then that puts a more positive spin on it, that he's taking the Chinese worker girls to the place where they'll have more power. That I like. I hadn't thought of any other amplification. But still, I question whether he knows the way, because he's returning to his parents. His father was an atheist who abandoned his Judaism, and his mother sounded like a pretty conventional Christian. In any case, I think you can see the positive meaning of the dream in that it shows up the Chinese image. And apparently the Chinese have come from China to here. So there is a move of that relativistic standpoint closer to his consciousness. But I'm not sure that we see in this dream the necessary resources for making that conscious. And that is perhaps why the wife cannot understand. So it's a step in the right direction, but with plenty of red flags. As we'll see, this never does take hold. He's going to flip back. And here I think we see why. There's an attempt to deal with it, but maybe because of the parental, his relying on parental tools, which would be like cynicism and superficiality, it's not going to happen. And I think we see perhaps the same issue in the next stream. Again, I'm interpreting this differently than the author, but you can, and I'm not certain about this, so you can compare the two. I'm with my assistant, Schaffroth, in my office in the physics building on Gloria Strasse. That's where it was, near the Etehausen Urban Campus. And I am discussing with him plans concerning my lecture. The sun is shining very brightly in the room. There's a knock on the door and a blonde woman comes in. She places a new inkwell on my desk along with the other writing articles. Then I say to my assistant that I am immediately going down to the lecture hall and give the lecture, otherwise the people in the auditorium will have to wait too long for me. He gives the sun a positive twist, but I keep thinking it should be moonlight. And we have the blonde. We've seen that the blonde represented the theory of the unity of matter and spirit. And the dark woman represented the experience of the unity of matter and spirit. So twice for me there are red flags. The author doesn't say it, but that's my take. I don't think it really matters practically, because it isn't going to happen. We'll see, it's not going to happen. Maybe the dream shows us why. But really, for the purposes of our discussion, what is important is that the Chinese image is the unconscious's response to his view that God cannot become conscious. If God can't become conscious, there are no opposites. If there are no opposites, there's no reason to become conscious, and the Chinese image shows the value of both the light and the dark, which then is what you have to struggle with if you are trying to make the God image in yourself conscious. Because the unconscious God image would be this polarity. That, to me, is the important image. Whether you, what you make of the fine points of a dream is another matter. That takes us, I think, roughly to 87. And, right before the quote, I would very much like, see where I am? I think what I've said is just what's been written there. And really, the quote I would very much like is something we've already covered, but I'll pick up with that next week. just to kind of prime the pump a little bit, and we'll finish this idea and then see how the unconscious continues to drive home to him the error of saying God can't become conscious because it means I can't become conscious. But also, hopefully, you can see how this expands beyond Pali to really our understanding of theology and where theology has been inadequate and how future theology must develop to take account of these facts. There it's got its broader impact. So I'm always trying to show you Pali's personal issue and then what it means in the larger sense. And I don't think most theology, I'm not that familiar with process theology. Maybe that has made a start. Is dealing with these issues. It was a lot of material, huh?
Interesting, though.
Okay, that takes us to 87. I had you read to what, 92?
Yes.
I depend that we will get into Answer to Job next time. I don't know how much time you'll need on Answer to Job, but read through it. That's chapter 9. I'll just review Answer to Job, and that is really just setting the stage for chapter 10. So depending on how much time it takes, we may spend the whole week time next time on chapter 9, but read through chapter 10 in case we don't need much time on it, because 9 just prepares the way for 10.
So that's two page...
111. Most of you know Answer to Job, so I think that will go fast. And depending on how much time you need, we'll spend as much time on that. It's pretty much like what we talked about today, that God becoming conscious. Thank you.
Thank you.